Welcome back to another deep dive. Whether you are prepping for a big meeting today or, you're just insanely curious about how the world works, we have something completely perspective shifting for you today.
We really do. I mean, it's one of those frameworks that once you see it, you start seeing it everywhere.
Oh, absolutely. So usually when we talk about solving a problem, there's this expectation of like precision, right? Like
yeah.
If you break your arm, the x-ray shows a jagged white line and the doctor just points at it.
Right. Broken or not broken, it's totally binary.
Exactly. You put a cast on it and you know exactly what the outcome is going to be. It's super straightforward.
And that is deeply comforting to human psychology. I mean, we naturally gravitate toward problems that are visible, categorizable, and directly fixable. Our entire industrial worldview is built on that linear cause and effect relationship.
But then you step into the world of complex systems, right? The human body, the global economy, the management of a massive organization, and suddenly that x-ray machine is just broken. We're looking at a problem-solving landscape that is completely murky.
It is. It's incredibly dense.
Which brings us to the source material we are unpacking today. We have a fascinating 2026 paper by Dr. Bechara Sakali. It's titled Operationalizing Viability, a Constraint-Based Framework for Intervention in Complex Systems.
It's a heavy title, but the concepts are, well, they're revolutionary.
Yeah. The core mission of our deep dive today is to understand why our default, intuitive way of solving complex problems, whether in our bodies or our economy, actually guarantees their eventual collapse. And, we want to uncover the framework required to actually fix them.
Right. Because we live in a society that is just entirely obsessed with the control paradigm.
The control paradigm.
Yeah. We pick a metric and we try to force that metric to hit a target. And what this paper argues, with a lot of mathematical rigor, I might add, is that applying this control paradigm to a complex adaptive system is exactly what drives catastrophic failure.
Okay, let's unpack this. What exactly is the control paradigm, and why is it failing us across so many different disciplines?
Well, across medicine, engineering, economics, governance, our standard operating procedure is to manage these complex systems by regulating what the author calls observable variables.
Observable variables. Give me some examples of those.
Sure. So in medicine, that might be blood pressure. In economics, it's GDP or, the inflation rate. In a wastewater treatment plant, it's the chemical composition of the effluent.
Okay, that makes sense.
We treat these observable variables as the primary targets of our intervention. We just assume that if we keep these numbers within an acceptable range, the system itself must be healthy.
I mean, that seems entirely rational to me. If my blood pressure is normal, I must be healthy, right? It's a proxy for health.
In a simple linear system, yes. Like if your car is going too fast, you take your foot off the gas, the speed drops, and the system responds exactly as intended.
Right. Cause and effect.
Exactly. But a complex adaptive system doesn't have a gas pedal. In these systems, observable variables are not causal levers you can just pull. They're reflections.
Reflections.
Yeah, they are emergent outcomes of incredibly dense underlying networks of relationships that are all trying to balance themselves.
So by treating a reflection as a target, we are fundamentally misunderstanding what the number even represents. It's like we're driving down the highway, the check engine light comes on, and our big fix is just to put a piece of black tape over the dashboard light.
That is a perfect analogy.
Right. We've controlled the observable variable, the annoying red light is gone, but the engine is still literally destroying itself.
It's actually worse than just ignoring the engine. By forcing the variable, you are actively accelerating the engine's destruction.
Wait, really? How does it accelerate it?
Well, when you use external control to force an observable variable to hit a specific number, you create a structural misalignment. You might be maintaining stability on the surface, but internally, the system is accumulating massive strain.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The components of the system are being forced to work against their own internal regulatory mechanisms just to satisfy your external demand.
That creates a rather terrifying dynamic because it implies that surface stability is actually a completely unreliable indicator of a system's health. Like, we could look fine but be dying.
It is the most characteristic failure dynamic of complex systems. Surface stability is rigidly preserved while the underlying capacity of the system is progressively hollowed out.
It looks completely fine on the spreadsheet.
Right up until the moment it abruptly transitions into total collapse.
I look at modern corporate culture, and this maps perfectly onto our obsession with quarterly metrics.
Oh, totally.
Say a corporation needs to hit a specific profit target for Wall Street. The observable variable is quarterly earnings. So to force that variable up, leadership slashes research and development, they cut employee benefits, and they demand everyone work weekends.
And for 3 months, the variable looks fantastic.
Exactly. The stock price jumps. But beneath the surface, they're burning out their workforce, bleeding their top talent, and completely destroying the innovation pipeline that actually ensures their long-term survival.
You are describing the exact mechanism of how control converts adaptive capacity into compensatory effort. The company is doing more and more frantic work just to maintain the illusion of stability.
But if observable variables are just reflections, and forcing them is inherently disruptive, the natural question is, like, what should we be measuring instead?
Right, that's the million-dollar question. Mm. If you open the hood, what are the actual components of the engine we need to look at, if not the dashboard lights?
Exactly.
This is where the framework provides a really crucial decomposition. The paper breaks complex systems down into four highly coupled components.
Okay, let's hear them.
Load, adaptation, reserve, and structure. And these four elements apply universally, whether you're analyzing a single human cell or an entire nation state.
Load, adaptation, reserve, and structure. Let's define the boundaries of each of those. Let's start with load.
Load is the demand placed on the system from its environment. It's the stress, you know, the requirement to perform work.
Okay, got it. And structure.
Structure is the observable configuration and the output. This is the part we normally measure and obsess over. The blood pressure, the profit margin.
Right, the stuff on the dashboard. What about adaptation?
Adaptation is the active effort the system exerts to maintain that structure in the face of the load.
Okay. And the last one, reserve.
Reserve is the underlying hidden capacity that sustains that adaptation over time.
So they are highly coupled, meaning they constantly pull on each other. Like, if I increase the load, the system must increase its adaptation.
Precisely.
But adaptation requires energy, which means it consumes reserve. And reserve is what ultimately supports the structure.
That is the exact relational loop.
Yeah.
You cannot change one without impacting all the others. So viability, therefore, is not a single number on a chart. It is the relational state where these four elements remain in dynamic balance.
Okay, but the trick here is that structure is visible, but reserve is essentially invisible, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. That is the core problem.
Going back to that corporate example, the profit margin, the structure, is highly visible. But the employee goodwill and the cash runway, the reserve, are much harder to quantify until they are completely gone. How does a practitioner actually measure reserve if it's inherently unobservable?
Well, you don't measure reserve directly. You measure the cost of adaptation.
The cost of adaptation? How so?
You look at how much effort the system is expending simply to maintain its baseline structure. If the output remains the same, but the internal friction, the required energy, or the necessary interventions are steadily climbing, you can reliably infer that reserve is being depleted.
So we are blind to the most critical component of the systems we rely on. We're walking around trusting institutions and biological metrics that are structurally hollowed out.
It happens all the time.
So what is the breaking point when that balance is finally lost? What actually happens to the system?
It falls into what the author defines as the load trap.
The load trap.
Yeah. Load trap occurs when increasing demand is met with increasing effort in a system that possesses a finite reserve.
Which is, I mean, literally every system in existence.
Exactly. Let's trace the mechanics of this trap because it's fascinating. The environmental load increases. In response, the system dials up its adaptive effort to maintain its visible structure.
Okay. Making sense so far.
And as we established, that effort aggressively consumes reserve. As the reserve drops, the overall effectiveness of the system begins to degrade. It enters a phase of diminishing returns.
So it's exerting more energy but achieving less actual work.
Right. But because effectiveness is dropping, the system is forced to exert even more effort just to stay in the exact same place.
Oh, wow. That is a vicious feedback loop.
It is. The extra effort depletes the remaining reserve at an accelerated rate, which requires even more effort. Until the system just consumes itself entirely.
It's the ultimate burnout cycle. It's literally cannibalizing its own internal organs to keep the skin looking healthy. But here is the friction for me. This completely contradicts human intuition. Well, in almost every aspect of life, from childhood sports to academic study, we are conditioned to believe that when things get difficult, the solution is to try harder. Escalate your effort. Push through the wall.
I know. But in a complex system depleted of reserve, trying harder is the exact mechanism of collapse.
Trying harder causes the collapse.
Yes. Effort that is no longer supported by reserve becomes actively destabilizing. Beyond a critical threshold, Increasing your effort makes the system fundamentally less stable.
That reframes so many catastrophic failures for me. Look at chronic fatigue syndrome in human biology.
A perfect example.
A patient is under some massive systemic load, right? A viral infection, chronic stress, and their immune and nervous systems deplete their biological reserve fighting it.
Right.
If that patient follows the standard advice to just push through it, to go to the gym and work harder, they don't get stronger. They experience a total physiological crash. Their own exertion becomes the weapon that destroys their remaining function.
The biological application of the load trap is undeniable, but it scales perfectly to macro systems too.
Like what?
Consider the collapse of global supply chains we've seen in recent years. Demand for goods spikes. That is an immense increase in load.
Right, everyone ordering stuff online.
Exactly. The shipping industry attempts to adapt by running factories 24/7 and routing more ships across the ocean. But the physical ports have a finite reserve. Limited dock space, limited truck drivers.
So efficiency drops. Ships start piling up off the coast of California or wherever.
And how do corporations respond to that drop in efficiency? They order more goods much earlier to ensure they have inventory.
Which dramatically increases the load again.
Yes. It requires even more ships, which completely exhaust the last remaining slivers of port reserve, leading to total gridlock. They tried to solve the delay by trying harder, and the effort itself broke the entire network.
If the cycle of diminishing returns is this predictable, from human bodies to cargo ships, why are we constantly blindsided by these collapses? Shouldn't there be warning signs flashing everywhere before a supply chain or a patient crashes?
We don't see the warnings because we are looking in the wrong place. We are staring at the structure. And this brings us to a concept the author calls the structural shadow.
The structural shadow, what is that?
The structural shadow is the dangerous, hidden divergence between what is superficially observed and what is mechanistically happening internally.
A divergence, so the surface metrics are actively lying to us.
The outputs appear perfectly stable. Blood pressure is within range. Shipping containers are still arriving. But internally, the effort required to produce that stability is spiking exponentially, and the reserve is collapsing.
It's just a facade.
Exactly. The system is only held together by immense unsustainable strain. The structural shadow is that gap. It is the earliest and most reliable warning sign of instability.
But to see it, we have to stop asking, you know, did we hit the target number, and start asking, at what internal cost did we hit this number?
We must shift our focus from values to direction. It is no longer about hitting a specific coordinate. It is about evaluating whether the system's trajectory is moving toward or away from viability.
The paper introduces some fairly intense mathematics to map this trajectory. There is a concept called the E7 quartic invariant, denoted as delta. I'll admit, reading through those differential equations was pretty daunting.
It is dense, for sure.
How does this mathematical concept translate to practical problem solving?
Well, we can bypass the dense algebra by understanding what an invariant represents conceptually. In physics, an invariant is a property of a system that remains unchanged under some transformation, like the conservation of energy.
Okay.
In Saheeli's framework, the E7 quartic invariant is not a number you can measure on a dashboard. You cannot draw blood and read a patient's invariant.
Then what is its practical utility? If I can't measure it, how do I use it?
It represents the mathematical envelope of viability. It is a boundary line of coherence.
An envelope of viability.
Think of it as an invisible perimeter around the system. As long as the relationship between load, adaptation, reserve, and structure stays within this envelope, the system can heal and function.
And if it crosses the line?
If the system crosses that mathematical boundary, it loses its coherence and begins to disintegrate. Viability isn't a target you can shoot for. It is a fundamental condition that must be respected.
And crossing that boundary is tied to another property of complex systems mentioned in the paper, non-associativity, path dependence.
Yes, exactly. In simple arithmetic, operations are associative. Adding 2 plus 3 gives you the same result as adding 3 plus 2. The order doesn't matter.
Right.
But in complex systems, actions are deeply non-associative. Every time you intervene, you permanently alter the context of the system.
It's like baking. You can't mix the flour, sugar, and eggs, bake it for an hour, and then realize you forgot the baking powder and just, you know, sprinkle it on top of the finished cake.
Right. It doesn't work that way.
The order of operations fundamentally changes the chemical structure. You can't unbake the cake.
Exactly. You cannot evaluate any intervention outside of its historical and relational context. A medication that saves a patient's life on Tuesday might kill them on Thursday, simply because the patient's internal reserve has been altered in the intervening 48 hours.
This creates a massive practical dilemma, though. If our interventions permanently alter the system, and if traditional control forcing a variable eventually hollows out the reserve and destroys the system, what are we supposed to do in an emergency?
It's a great question.
Because if a patient is bleeding out or an economy is in free fall, practitioners can't just stand back and passively observe the structural shadow. Action is absolutely required.
And the framework does not advocate for nihilism or passive observation. It resolves this tension through what the author calls the dual scale paradigm.
The dual scale paradigm.
Yes. It cleanly divides intervention into two distinct phases with entirely different operational logics. Phase one is acute stabilization. Phase two is constraint-based navigation.
Walk me through phase one. The system is actively crashing. What is the mechanism of acute stabilization?
In phase one, the system has lost its internal regulatory capacity. It is actively falling outside that mathematical envelope of viability we just discussed. If left alone, it will cease to exist.
Right.
In this narrow acute window, you absolutely must use direct control. You use brute force to push the observable variables back into a survivable range to restore minimal function.
So if someone's heart stops, you don't sit there worrying about their long-term biological reserve. You do chest compressions. You physically force the blood to flow. You control the variable.
Exactly. You intervene to prevent irreversible collapse. However, this is the crux of the entire paradigm. This stabilization is not free, and it is not a cure.
It has a cost.
Yes. Phase I control saves the system, but it imposes massive internal strain. You are substituting your external control for the system's internal regulation. By doing so, you rapidly accumulate what the paper terms coherence debt.
Coherence debt. It functions exactly like financial debt, doesn't it?
It really does.
You use a credit card to survive an emergency today, but you have to pay it back later with interest or you go bankrupt.
It is a physiological or systemic debt. Mm-hmm. The system appears stable. The heart is beating again. The market has stopped crashing. But its actual capacity to sustain that stability independently has been severely degraded.
The act of stabilization creates the very conditions that must later be resolved.
Which brings us to the single most dangerous moment in the lifespan of a complex system, the temporal boundary.
The temporal boundary. How do we define that?
It is the inflection point. It is the exact moment the system is no longer in immediate acute danger of structural collapse, and it begins to demonstrate some basic responsiveness. It is the moment you must transition from phase I brute force control to phase II navigation.
And what happens if a practitioner misses that boundary?
If you fail to recognize the temporal boundary and you continue to apply phase I control just because you like how stable the numbers look, you will trigger a secondary, often irreversible collapse.
Oh, wow.
Phase I control is justified only insofar as it creates a bridge to phase II. If you keep forcing the variable after the acute danger has passed, you drive the system straight into the load trap. You exhaust whatever reserves survive the initial crisis, and the system dies not from the original injury, but from your intervention.
It is literally a medical tourniquet. If a patient is bleeding out on the street from a severed artery, applying a tourniquet absolutely saves their life. You restrict the flow, you control the variable. That is phase one.
Yes.
But once you reach the temporal boundary, right, the patient is in the hospital, the bleeding is surgically managed. If you leave that tourniquet on because, well, it's working and the numbers look good, the lack of blood flow will kill the tissue, the limb will die, the cure becomes the poison.
A tourniquet creates massive coherence debt in the form of tissue hypoxia. It must be removed at the temporal boundary. And this requires practitioners to completely invert their logic.
Invert their logic.
In phase two, constraint-based navigation, the objective is no longer to preserve output. The objective is to restore the internal conditions that make output sustainable.
But practically, how does a practitioner take the tourniquet off without the patient bleeding to death again? How do we execute phase two navigation without losing the stability we just fought so hard for?
It requires a highly disciplined methodology. The MAPR outlines the Viability Navigation Protocol, or VNP.
Okay, the VNP.
It is not a rigid checklist, but an iterative clinical loop. First, you determine the operational regime. Are we actively collapsing in phase one, or have we reached the temporal boundary?
Makes sense.
Second, you assess the system relationally. You don't just look at the blood pressure. You evaluate the interplay of load, adaptation, reserve, and structure.
The whole picture.
Third, you diagnose the pattern of instability. Is the system falling into a load trap? Are we seeing a rapidly expanding structural shadow?
You form a hypothesis about the invisible components based on the visible strain.
Yes. Fourth, You select an intervention designed not to hit a target, but to alter the constraints. Fifth, you evaluate the system's systemic response. And finally, you iteratively adjust based on that response.
I really need to see the mechanism of this protocol in a real-world scenario to fully wrap my head around it. The paper provides a clinical case study of acute decompensated heart failure. Let's walk through the mechanics of that specific case.
Sure. So a patient presents in the emergency department in acute distress. Blood pressure is dangerously low, heart rate is rapid, fluid is backing up into the lungs, and urine output has dropped.
Basically, everything is crashing.
Right. Most importantly, lab results show highly elevated lactate levels. High lactate indicates that the tissues are suffocating. They are not receiving enough oxygen to perform cellular respiration.
So the system is actively falling outside the envelope of viability. This is unequivocally phase I.
The doctors act accordingly. They initiate acute stabilization. They administer powerful vasopressor medications to force the blood vessels to constrict, mechanically driving the blood pressure up.
And they administer supplemental oxygen, I assume.
Right, and the intervention works. The blood pressure stabilizes on the monitor. The acute spiral is halted.
The tourniquet is applied, but we have to look for the coherence debt. We have to look for the structural shadow.
And it emerges quickly. The blood pressure, the observable structure, looks acceptable. But the lactate levels remain stubbornly high. The urine output remains low. And the patient requires escalating doses of the vasopressor medication just to maintain that baseline blood pressure.
The adaptive effort is increasing, which means the internal reserve is still dropping. The system is stable on the screen, but internally it is heavily strained.
They have reached the temporal boundary. The immediate threat of cardiac arrest is paused, but the internal debt is mounting. Here, the practitioner must transition to phase II, and the logic of intervention must completely reverse.
What does that actually mean for the doctor standing over the bed? What did they do?
Well, in phase I, the goal was to increase effort to maintain output. In phase II, the focus shifts to reducing systemic demand, decreasing the compensatory effort, and restoring the reserve.
Okay.
The physician must shift their priority from pressure to perfusion, from the static number on the screen to the actual flow of blood through the tissues.
Wait, I have to push back here.
Okay, go ahead.
If I am the ICU doctor and I have a critically ill patient, every single alarm in that room, every instinct from my medical training, and quite frankly, the hospital's malpractice liability protocols are demanding that I keep that blood pressure above a specific threshold.
Yes, they are.
Are you saying the doctor has to actively turn down the life support medications?
Yes, and that is precisely why this framework is so difficult to operationalize. If the doctor gives in to the institutional pressure to treat the monitor and pushes more medication to force the blood pressure higher, they trigger what Solarelli calls the squeeze condition.
The squeeze condition.
The medication constricts the blood vessels so tightly that while the pressure inside them goes up, the actual flow of blood to the organs is severely restricted.
They are strangling the organs to make the numbers look good.
They are increasing the workload on a failing heart, the load, while it possesses zero reserve. It is a direct pathway to multi-organ failure.
So the doctor has to make the terrifying decision to let a vital sign look worse in order to save the patient's internal capacity. They dial back the vasopressors, the blood pressure drops slightly. How do they know they aren't just letting the patient die?
They evaluate the systemic response. If they reduce the medication, lowering the externally imposed adaptive effort, and they observe that the patient's lactate levels begin to clear and urine output slowly increases, that tells them that actual tissue perfusion is improving.
The internal organs are breathing again.
Exactly. The reserve is beginning to recover. The system is moving back toward a viable trajectory, even though the observable variable of blood pressure is technically lower than the textbook ideal.
Success is inferred from the response of the whole system, not computed in advance by a target metric.
Right.
It requires immense discipline to tolerate a period of apparent numerical vulnerability to achieve actual structural healing. We are essentially allowing the system to reestablish its own coherence.
We are removing the constraints that prevent it from healing rather than overriding it with brute force.
We've explored this in extreme granular detail within human biology, but the paper makes a much bolder claim. It states this constraint-based framework is domain agnostic. It applies to engineered infrastructure, macroeconomics, and governance.
It does.
I want to test this cross-domain generalization. Can we really map the mechanics of a failing human heart onto municipal infrastructure? Let's start with the engineering example. wastewater treatment.
The mapping is seamless because the underlying dynamics of complex systems do not care about the medium. In a wastewater treatment plant, the load is the volume and toxicity of the incoming sewage. The structure, the observable variable we regulate, is the purity of the effluent water discharged into the river. The adaptation is the chemical dosing, the UV blasting, and the mechanical aeration the operators apply.
And the reserve?
The reserve is the biological health of the system. Wastewater treatment heavily relies on massive colonies of bacteria and anaerobic digesters to break down the organic matter. The diversity, density, and health of that bacterial colony is the system's true capacity.
So what does the load trap look like here?
A massive storm causes a surge of contaminated runoff, a massive spike in load. The observable effluent quality begins to drop.
Phase I emergency.
Right. The operators engage in phase I control. They dump heavy chemical coagulants into the system and maximize the aeration blowers to force the effluent quality back to regulatory standards. And it works perfectly. The water leaving the plant is clean.
But they are accumulating coherence debt.
Precisely. If they miss the temporal boundary and maintain this aggressive chemical posture, the harsh chemicals and excessive oxygen begin to decimate the biological reserve.
The bacteria.
The bacterial colonies die off. Now the system's intrinsic ability to break down waste is gone. To compensate, the operators have to add even more chemicals and run the blowers even harder just to achieve the same water quality.
They are trapped.
They are trapped. The effort required is spiraling, and the underlying capacity is zero.
To fix it, they have to tolerate a drop in observable efficiency. They have to back off the chemicals, perhaps even temporarily fail to meet peak effluent standards, to give the biological colonies time to regrow.
It is the exact same mechanism as dialing back the blood pressure medication to let the organs breathe.
Let's scale this up to something even more abstract, economics, because this framework feels like a master key for understanding financial crises. Let's look at the mechanisms of central banking.
Macroeconomics is perhaps the most glaring example of the control paradigm failing at scale.
Let's map it out.
In an economic system, the load is debt burdens, inflation, or external supply shocks. The structure is our output, GDP growth, employment figures, the S&P 500 index.
The stuff on the news.
Right. The adaptation is macroeconomic policy intervention. Central banks adjusting interest rates, quantitative easing, corporate bailouts.
And the reserve, what is the biological colony of an economy?
The reserve is actual productive capacity. It is the real savings of the middle class. It is institutional trust, physical infrastructure, and the genuine innovation of the private sector.
So let's run a historical case study through this lens. The 2008 financial crisis, or the economic shocks of 2020.
When a massive shock hits the financial system, markets freeze. That is phase I acute collapse. Central banks correctly intervene with acute stabilization. They slash interest rates to zero and inject trillions of dollars in liquidity through quantitative easing.
They act as the lender of last resort.
Exactly. They apply the financial tourniquet to prevent the entire global banking system from disintegrating overnight.
And no one argues with the necessity of that tourniquet, but it's what happens at the temporal boundary.
Exactly. Once the acute panic subsides, the temporal boundary is reached. The system needs to transition to phase two. It needs to deleverage. Inefficient companies need to be allowed to fail to clear out bad debt. Interest rates need to normalize so that risk can be priced accurately.
Right.
But central banks, terrified of any drop in the observable structure, like a dip in the stock market or a rise in short-term unemployment, they miss the temporal boundary. They leave the tourniquet on for 15 years.
They keep interest rates near zero and continue quantitative easing for over a decade. They keep pushing the vasopressors to keep the market's blood pressure high. What is the structural shadow of that decision?
The structural shadow is immense fragility. By suppressing the natural regulatory mechanisms of the market, they create a massive coherence debt. Zombie companies, businesses that do not make enough profit to even cover the interest on their debt, are kept alive by artificially cheap money.
Oh, wow.
Asset prices, like housing and stocks, detach completely from real economic value. The effort required by the central bank to keep the market from throwing a tantrum increases every year.
And the reserve, the savings of the middle class, is entirely hollowed out by the resulting inflation and the loss of purchasing power.
Exactly.
The system looks incredibly wealthy on paper, but it has zero capacity to absorb a real shock. They substituted the effort of the printing press for the genuine capacity of a productive economy.
Use the load trap on a civilizational scale.
Yeah.
Restoring stability wouldn't require printing more money. It would require the painful, counterintuitive process of reducing the systemic load, allowing the observable metrics to drop, and doing the slow work of rebuilding real savings and productive capacity.
This brings us to the highest and most consequential application of the framework: governance and institutional power. How does constraint-based navigation explain the collapse of nation-states or the breakdown of social order?
Well, in a system of governance, the load takes the form of demographic shifts, economic inequality, or external geopolitical pressure.
Okay.
The structure is street-level order, legal compliance, the daily functioning of society. The adaptation is the enforcement mechanism of the state: police power, judicial action, centralized mandates.
And the reserve?
The reserve is legitimacy. It is social cohesion. It is the implicit trust the population has in the social contract.
So when a society experiences a crisis, say severe economic inequality leading to massive street protests, how does the state usually respond?
The default response is almost always quasi control. The state increases its adaptive effort. It deploys riot police, tightens surveillance, and centralizes authority to force the observable variable street-level compliance back into the acceptable range.
Right. And in a moment of total acute anarchy, a brief application of this may be necessary to prevent violence.
It might be.
Yeah.
But the state rarely recognizes the temporal boundary. The state views compliance as the ultimate metric of success. But cracking down heavily on a population consumes legitimacy at an astonishing rate. If the state relies on enforcement as its primary long-term strategy, rather than addressing the underlying load, like the inequality or the corruption, they fall into the ultimate load trap.
The structural shadow expands, the streets look quiet, but the internal pressure is boiling.
Exactly. The state has to apply more and more force, pass stricter and stricter laws, just to maintain the same baseline of basic compliance. The enforcement effort eventually consumes all remaining social trust.
They hollow out their own reserve.
And when the reserve hits zero, the system doesn't just slowly degrade, it abruptly shatters. The revolution or the collapse happens overnight, and the leaders are always shocked because right up until the day it broke, the observable variables looked fine.
They substituted police effort for the actual capacity of public trust. This is a profound synthesis. Whether we are talking about a failing human heart pumped full of vasopressors, a global economy strung out on quantitative easing, a wastewater plant drowning in chemicals, or an authoritarian government relying on riot police, the fatal error is mathematically identical.
It really is.
We squeeze the system tighter to maintain the illusion of stability, and by doing so, we destroy its internal capacity to heal.
That is the defining insight of Dr. Safely's framework. Across all domains, catastrophic failure occurs when effort substitutes for capacity over time. If practitioners, whether they are ICU doctors, Federal Reserve chairmen, or city planners, could shift their worldview from target chasing to constraint-based navigation, we could fundamentally alter how we interact with the complex systems that sustain human life.
It requires a profound humility. It requires accepting that we cannot master these systems by forcing them to obey our spreadsheets. We have to design interventions that respect their internal boundaries.
That's the only way forward.
Let's take a moment to synthesize the immense ground we've covered today. We started by dismantling the control paradigm, realizing that targeting observable variables is fundamentally destructive in complex systems.
Right.
We learned to look past the structure and recognize the structural shadow, where surface stability masks the rapid hollowing out of internal reserve. We unpacked the mechanics of the load trap, proving that trying harder without reserve is the exact mechanism of collapse.
Exact.
We established the life or death stakes of the temporal boundary, the absolute necessity of knowing when to take the tourniquet off. And we saw how phase two navigation demands that we abandon our obsession with targets and instead manage constraints to allow the system to heal itself.
The power of this framework is its practical utility for the listener. You don't need to be managing a global economy to apply this.
No, not at all.
If you were managing a team of developers, leading a family through a crisis, or navigating your own physical health, this framework provides a diagnostic lens. You must constantly audit your own actions. Am I just forcing an observable variable right now, or am I doing the slow, invisible work of building reserve?
It forces you to completely reevaluate the nature of effort, which leaves me with a final lingering thought for you to carry with you this week. We now know that relentlessly pushing for surface stability, trying harder and harder to hit the target while ignoring the internal cost, is the exact mathematical recipe for systemic collapse.
It's guaranteed.
So look inward. Where in your own life or in your own career are you blindly escalating your adaptive effort while secretly depleting your own physical or emotional reserve? Are you caught in your own personal load trap? Are you covering up the check engine light while your engine burns out?
The first step to survival is recognizing when to stop controlling and when to start navigating.
Even when the diagnostic waters are murky and the traditional tools fail us, we can find a viable path forward. We just have to stop obsessing over the surface and start respecting the structure beneath. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us. We will see you next time.